Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the marvellous Sarah Morgan.
Hello.
Hello, Morgs.
Hello.
Hiya.
We've been discussing her fear of people tapping.
We've been discussing how skeeved out I am by body talk and other things where people pop and click and do that thing. It was very big in the 80s, wasn't it?
It took a simple clap.
It was like a cappella, but more and terrifying.
Yeah.
The nightmare that is Bobby McFerrin.
I'm going to unpack it now, like on my podcast, which I think is because it's very physical and very body-centric, which when you're a child is a bit like, stop having bodies.
Stop reminding me of armpits.
Yeah, stop reminding me of things.
My dad used to do the... thing quite a lot, you know.
Whoa.
He used to play whole tunes on his cheek.
That's just dadness. At some point, as a dad, you become a musical instrument and pom around the house, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I find myself doing that, tapping on steering wheels while at traffic lights.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm married to a drummer. He literally doesn't stop playing his body. That sounds weird. Yeah, cut that.
Keep that bit.
Have you been working today?
I have been working today. I've been at a bore place for the BBC Writers' Room
doing my little.
Yeah, it's lovely. They invite me to go and do my little dog and pony show about how to write a sitcom family. Yeah.
We've borrowed that so many times on this. I credit you because it's not yours. I know it's Mitch Hurwitz's, but it kind of belongs to you.
I feel like I sort of popularised it amongst the comedy community in the UK, a bit like sort of Rufus Wainwright's version of Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Or Alexander Burke's version of Hallelujah, whichever you prefer. It's funny you mention that, actually, because you may not want to keep this in, I don't know, but did you know there's a Rule of Three drinking game?
Was there?
Yeah. We're long friends, I'm a fan of the show, other members
what,
of
you mean about this
about
podcast?
This podcast, yeah.
What?
Yeah, so it's two comedy writers who we know and love, who I've asked if I can name them, and they said if you find it funny. Right. So...
All right, let's see.
But they have a sort of drinking game with the things that come up on Rule of Three. One of them is... Joel slightly butchering the matriarch-patriarch cross-running clown paradigm and saying things like taking the front off the watch and John Cleese is the headmaster. The first thing you're allowed to like on your own. There's a sort of list of things. And my favourite one is when Jason doesn't say anything for a while and then just goes, it's fucking funny though, isn't it? So that's Tom Neenan and Ben Partridge.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's their drinking game, and they told me about it, and I was like, that is fucking beautiful. And if I ever go on Rule of Three,
let's see if we can get them completely hammered today.
Yeah.
It is fucking funny.
It is fucking funny.
That's the only excuse.
that's ridiculous, though. We've become parodies, then, haven't we?
I mean, like
we are parodists. for a living and pasticheurs for a living, but we're becoming a parody.
Or catchphrases could be another nicer way of putting it.
That's true, yeah. Quotable. I mean, I suppose, yeah.
But I was always worried about that because you work on sort of impression shows and things, and you think, effectively, your meat and potatoes on an impression show, if you're not doing mean stuff about how someone looks, is you're picking up their turns of phrase. And you think, the moment you start recording yourself, and everyone hates hearing themselves back on tape for the first time, you suddenly realise you have tics. I mean, I have them because I edit this show, so I'm fed up with my own laugh. I'm fed up with the way I phrase things. I'm fed up with the things. I've got tells for when I'm thinking that I can hear. I cut most of them out. But a lot of the time, I can tell when I'm thinking and talking at the same time.
Well, you taught me how to edit. Joel, you taught me how to use Audacity when I was editing my podcast, The Fear, which is a fine, great, big owl podcast.
It really is.
Thank you. You've both been guests.
It's fucking fun.
And I just made the noise, which is the one you told me about, which is that arm is shaped like a bullet.
Arm is shaped like a bullet.
And now I know what an arm looks like and I take it out. That and me just laughing for no fucking reason.
Right, yeah, first of all, it's quite gruesome. I often think that if anyone makes anything, I mean, one of the most useful things you can do, obviously, if you're a writer, is to get on set and see how things are made. But if you're someone who writes and talks and things, making a podcast is really good because you listen to how you talk and you listen to the tics you've got and the loops and the little digressions you have. And actually, it's quite a good way of hearing how people speak and how someone, again, talks when they're thinking. It's quite educational, sort of breaking yourself down because you listen to it in enormous detail in a way you wouldn't do when you're down the pub and just chatting to friends. It's actually quite an interesting breakdown. I quite like this sort of boom in audio, which means people are listening to other people talking quite carefully.
Yes. And it is fucking fun.
Now we've got the catchphrases, we're going to start doing them, aren't we?
Sorry, Tom and Ben.
Hammered yet? The problem
is that those things will remain true for almost anything. I think the interesting thing with this is where we say to people, bring on something. At the beginning, when we started doing this podcast, a lot of it was saying, bring on something that influenced you. So very often it was about things that you'd listened to when you were younger or when you were forming your tastes and things. And a lot of the time, that's stuff where there are headmasters and there are sort of families and things like that. The fun thing's been people bringing on stuff a bit like what we're going to do today, which maybe is when you're a bit older, when the values of the comedy are a bit different. They're not just jokes from when you were 17 and wanted to hear that teachers were stupid.
Well, that's the interesting thing, because you mentioned that it's not something you like when you're 17. I was 18 when I saw this for the first time.
Oh, perfect.
Because I am slightly younger than you.
Yeah.
And I think there's very few things that I remember when I saw them for the first time. And I love, by the way, that we've chosen something that isn't a sacred cow of comedy, like a big canonical Monty Python, South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, with Nell and I, where I'm going to be like shitting myself about getting it wrong and having people on the internet telling me off for it. Whereas this is like, you either have strong feelings about it or you've never fucking heard of it and you don't care.
What are we doing this week?
We are doing Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm exposed and it's no big surprise. Don't you think I know exactly where I stand? This world is forcing me to hold your hand. Cause I'm just a girl, a little lonely. Well, don't let me out of your sight. Oh, I'm just a girl.
You were 18 when you first saw it.
I was 18, so I can tell you exactly the time, place, everything where I was when I saw this for the first time. So it was 1998. It came out in cinemas in 97. I was living in Bristol. It was in a flat. I don't know whose flat it was. It was so late as to be early. And you can infer from all of this that I'd been enjoying a lot of orange squash that evening.
Right, yes.
It was popular in Bristol in the mid to late 90s.
So it was
certainly a time that a lot of people enjoyed orange squash on a night out.
The effects of orange squash.
The Ribena tooth kind. There were Robinson's barley water. They were all very popular amongst the youth in the 90s. And I was in a flat in Bristol and I was sort of surrounded by people who were sleeping off the effects of tomorrow's shoes. And I was awake and I was the only person awake in this flat full of people. And I looked over and next to the telly were those two great big blockbuster VHS cases that were about the size of a ship. They were massive, like a pair of trainers, enormous.
Huge puffy. Spice Girl shoes.
Yes, exactly. Like big buffalo trainers. And I was awake and the orange squash hadn't quite worn off, but I knew it was coming. So I watched the two films and one of them was Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery.
Yep.
Still a fantastic film. And the other one was Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. And it was the perfect sweet spot of where I was in my life. I was 18. It's a film sort of about 18-year-olds. And it just absolutely just smacked me in the face with how much I fell in love with it. And obviously I had to then check the next day that it wasn't the orange squash. And it wasn't. I've probably watched this film more than any other film in my life. And it's fucking funny, isn't it?
I think what's remarkable about this movie is you saw it when you were 18. So you saw it when the age. It's about high school reunion. And you saw it when the age of the girls when they're at high school.
Yeah, the sort of half the film is them as teenagers, half the film is them as 28-year-olds. Yeah.
I saw this in the golden summer of high school reunion movies because it came out the same time as Gross Point Blank. It was bumped.
Yes, that's right.
Its release date was bumped because Gross Point Blank was coming out literally the same month, so they shifted it.
Wow.
It's a year after Beautiful Girls, which I think is a very underrated high school reunion movie that I really like. There was a big bunch of these, and they were done because they could sell soundtracks off the back of them, nostalgia soundtracks to people. Ah. They would put the soundtrack on from 10 years earlier, so it'd be full of Cyndi Lauper and Madonna and things, but they could do them. And I saw it, I'm 10 years older than you, I saw it when I was the age of the reunion.
Yeah.
And so what it was for me, I saw it at the cinema. I'm that much of a no. I would at the time.
It's a very odd film for a dude to go and see at the cinema. I would go and see
anything at the cinema that looked like it was about high school, because I was such a teen movie fan, such a John Hughes fan, and I would go and see anything. So I went to see Clueless, I went to go and see this. I would see anything that was about teenagers at high school. I was mad for it. And this came out, it was a golden summer for nostalgia teen movies. And I went to see it, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I absolutely loved it. And the best thing that happened was when DVD came out as a piece of technology, my friend John, who also loved this movie, bought it for me as the first DVD I ever owned. And it was his way of saying, don't get Citizen Kane, get the movies you actually like. And it was a way of breaking my DVD collection so it wouldn't just have Raging Bull and things in it.
That's great.
I have, like you, I've watched this movie probably as much as any film I own.
Yeah.
And I love
this is interesting, because we've talked about me, if I was ever going to come on Rule of Three, we would talk about this. That was always a given. And I knew that we both loved this film. And I did not have any idea whether Jason had seen it. What happens when someone who's never seen it for the first time watches it? And Jason, tell me, I'm dying to know what you thought.
Yes,
and please be honest, because I can't imagine coming into it fresh.
I first saw this film this week at the age of 47.
Fantastic.
I've never seen it before.
No orange squash or lemon barley water or anything of the sort. Mainly coffee
Capri
and fizzy water. I loved it.
Yay!
I just thought it was delightful.
The nice thing is it doesn't matter if people don't love it, because it's not canon-y or whatever, but I'm so happy when people love it. I'm so glad you loved it.
Yeah, I really did. I thought it was very funny, very silly, and just big-hearted. I found that towards the end of the film, when comeuppances are happening, I was absolutely rooting for them, you know.
Yeah.
I was so pleased when everything got sorted out at the end.
Yeah.
And the beat before that, where suddenly they've been picked on again as adults in the same way that they were at high school. I was fucking furious. I was so cross.
But it's a film about, it really gets you. But obviously has female friendship at the core of it, but it also has this amazing message. It's a film about being bullied in high school and carrying that on into your adult life.
Yeah.
And the message of the film isn't just bullying is bad and friends are good. The moral of the film is also everyone feels like they were bullied at school. Everyone thinks they're the underdog, and everyone thinks someone else bullied them at school. And you find out at the end, we're getting to the end very quick, but not just that they confront their bullies, but also their people they bullied inadvertently or whose feelings they hurt come forward as well. And it just turns out that everyone at high school, at their high school and our high school and whatever, had a bad time.
I really thought you guys had it made in high school.
Us?
Yes, you with your long hair and your long legs, walking on your legs, flipping your hair. Can't compete with that. You made Sandy crazy. And the whole time you were making my life hell. The A group was making your life hell. I didn't know.
And no one knew about it because they were too busy thinking about their own.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful message that everyone is capable of cruelty.
Yes, I think that's
the internet.
I think I got towards the end, the first time watching this and rewatching. Every time I rewatch it, I get a thrill in my stomach as I realise it's going towards that inevitable denouement when it'll be revealed what's going on.
You know what? I bet in high school everybody made somebody's life hell.
Mm-mm, not me. Never had the opportunity to make anyone's life hell.
You know what? I bet that's not true. You were really unpleasant. You think? Oh.
Yeah.
And obviously, let's be honest about this. This is not a film that is heavy on plot.
Oh, no. There's plot holes in it you can drive a car through.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. That's another reason why I love it, because you can't comedy nerd out about it in the way that you can that something that's perfect and pick it to pieces, because it's not perfect. The plot is... There's a 20-minute dream sequence in the middle.
Yeah.
There's a plot hole related to that dream sequence that makes no fucking sense, no matter how you try to slice it. You can explain certain things that are just like, well, the characters might have done that and that's fine, but there's certain bits in it where you're just like, no.
But it doesn't care.
Something bad happened.
What it does is it doesn't care, but it's running at two levels all the way through, which I think is incredibly sophisticated and incredibly rare. It's very silly and it's just trying to delight you.
Yeah.
All it is, it's like a... It made me think of... I'm going to start here. I'm going to go in. I'm going to say, it made me think of The Merry Wives of Windsor. It's like one of those Shakespeare plays that's got no goodness in it at all.
Wasn't on Tom and Ben's list.
No, I know.
But it reminded me, I saw that recently, which is basically just a big sitcom with lot of mistaken identity and lots of cuckoldry. And then you went, he's not trying to do anything here apart from make everyone happy. All this is trying to do is make you happy. And you go, well, okay, well, you could do one of those movies. It is an Austin Powers. It is a Bill and Ted. It's just about delight. And it's not meant to, and nothing's supposed to get in the way of you just being entertained and thoroughly thrilled. But as the meat of it kicks in, and the meat of it isn't to do with plot or story, the meat of it's to do with characters. And it says that it has a message, and the message is, you were all bullied, and you all bullied. And this goes on into your life. And whenever you think that you're the victim, you're very often someone else is the victim underneath you. We're part of a circle of abuse and meanness.
And fear and, yeah.
And it's that's an incredibly sophisticated thing and a very sophisticated thing to do in a movie whose only job is to be silly and dress up and dance around.
Well, it sort of came off the back of... The studio wanted a female Wayne's World was the remit for it. And it came off the back of things like Clueless and those kind of things that were sort of silly, girly. The costumes were going to be amazing. That was going to have a great soundtrack.
Same costume designer as Clueless.
Yes.
It looks the same. It's brightly coloured. It looks like Jelly Babies. It's sweet.
Yes, exactly. Yes. But then, as you say, underpinning that with this amazing script by Robin Sheff, who I adore, and then directed by David Merkin, and who was from The Simpsons.
Simpsons showrunner for season 5.
And what's really interesting about it is that they didn't see eye to eye on so much of the film. Yeah, no, he had a very particular kind of vision for it, which I think when you read interviews with them, which are obviously done with the benefit of hindsight and all that kind of stuff, is that Robin Sheff was completely unhappy with his edit and he cut out loads of breathing space because he's Simpsons-y and joke. But when you listen to his version of events, his oral history, he says that he sort of introduced the dance sequence at the end and all these other moments that are really big emotional things that stay with you. So I find it really interesting. It's not a sort of harmonious, we had such a great time on set kind of film. It's actually a film made by lots of people who really had a particular idea of what they're making.
When you hear the accounts from Lisa Kudrow and from Mira Sorvino, they say it was really hard. And what's weird is it looks like they're really good friends and that glows out of it. There's a good chemistry and a good dynamic. But they said there were loads of takes. Nothing was done in one take. The improvisation was at the end of when you'd nailed the take, you were allowed to mess around. But it was a very disciplined, very complicated big shoot. It's a $17 million movie, which is a reasonable budget
and
for a silly
movie.
Most
of the money was spent on the soundtrack.
Yeah, Cyndi Lauper, I think it cost $240,000 to get Time After Time.
Which is worth every penny. When we get to that bit, it is worth every penny.
But that is to do with giving it an atmosphere and giving it a feel. It's a movie that's all about feel, and you buy that feel from beat one when you first meet the girls.
Should we summarise the plot for people who might not go and watch it? And if you don't go and watch it and you don't love it, it's fine. Maybe it's just not for you. Maybe it's just fine. But
it's a film that belongs to people, I think.
It really does.
I think it's a bit like when one of the strange things that happens to canonical comedy films, and I was going to say something, I will say something that I will stand at. I love this film as much as I pretend to love With Nail and I. Now, I love With Nail and I, but I don't love it as much as I love this one. And I think the thing about With Nail and I is because it's a huge classic film, it's obviously a great movie and things, people say they like it even if it doesn't quite belong to them. You go, well, of course it's unarguably brilliant. But I think this one I feel, because I saw it at the right age and I loved it so much, this belongs to me and I'm happy if you don't like it.
Yes.
Whereas With Nail and I go, well, unarguably it's brilliant. There's something about films that don't quite 100% work that make them belong to you more.
Well, I would say that I've watched With Nail and I, which I adore, dozens and dozens
fucking
of times.
It's fucking funny, isn't it?
It's fucking funny. But I've never found myself angry or rooting for either of those characters in the same way that I was in this film.
I'm so happy you were so emotionally invested because they're... I mean, sorry, I'm going to summarise
the plot.
As a professional...
It won't take long.
No. Oh, the plot is there are two women who are 28 and living together in LA. They are clearly best friends. They like clothes and clubbing and watching the film Pretty Woman and slagging it off. And they get an invitation to their high school reunion and we see lots of flashbacks to them as 18-year-olds who are, in their minds, bullied at school. They are... One of them is slightly overweight and one of them has a back brace and they are bullied by the popular cool girls at school. One of them puts fridge magnets on her back
I got excited when I put the
back brace girl, it's horrible. You get really
I put the DVD in and I put the titles on. I'm sitting watching it with my wife last night and I squealed as it went into it. Why? I'm thinking about the fridge magnets. I was excited the fridge magnets were coming.
It's so so they sort of so we see all these flashbacks to them at high school and then they decide they're going to go to their high school reunion but they're going to pretend they have turned out to be much better people than they were.
And their reunion is in Tucson, Arizona. Yeah. So they're going there with some LA swagger, basically.
Yes, so they're going to pretend that their lives are perfect. Because the Robin Schiff, when she said that, because she created these characters, and we should talk about how she came up with these characters, because it's all groundlings. And, you know, that sort of Elvira, Pee Wee Herman, that's the groundlings sort of generates these character-based things that you know, very American way of doing things. But she created these characters. Lisa Kudrow, apparently, the second that she said...
Hey, remember that time I barfed from bad Mexican food? It was so gross.
Oh, my God, I hate throwing up in public.
Me too!
Me too!
Yeah, me too! And the way she said, apparently, that was absolutely the key... for Robin Schiff, the character, it's like she overheard these two girls talking in a toilet, and she wrote a play about it called Ladies' Room, which is two girls talking in a toilet, and it's just that kind of inane kind of babble between women where it's just like, I love your dress, I love your dress, I hate throwing up in public, ah, me too! And I can't do it justice. It is one of those moments where she got out of the way of the performer and realised just how brilliant, but that phrase pops up all the way through the film. She had to then come up with all these things when she was trying to write a movie script, what would be the funniest situation to put these two women in, these two best friends? And she thought about the high school reunion thing. I thought about them filling out the form and not realising until the moment they filled out the form for their high school reunion where it says, what's your job? What's your marital status? What's your... that their lives were a bit shit. She thought that was a really funny idea that you would spend 10 years going, our lives are amazing, we live in LA, we've got this, and then actually sort of going, oh God, our jobs are crap.
It's a really good joke about being 28. And you go, well, you could get to 28 having... There's the thing when you're a teenager, of the biggest thing you don't want to do is give up.
Yeah.
All the fun. So you go, well, as long as I haven't given up the fun, then I've won. And you get 28, and there's that thing that is to do, that's a very, the pressure on women in women's magazines and things like that, to go, well, what have you got by now? Have you got the husband and the, are you still single? Have you got children? And them to tick off having completely succeeded on their own terms, not surrendering a bit of themselves, to then go, but by the standards of our culture, we've failed.
By the standards of the people who we were at high school with, who intimidated us and shaped our insecurities that we have today, we have failed. So they
Brilliant observation.
They decide... that they're going to go back to the reunion and pretend to be more successful than that. And they do this by putting on business suits, like the women, like the models in Vogue, and pretending they invented Post-its.
I know. Why don't we say that we own our own company?
Oh, good.
Like what?
Like what if we invented something?
Like what?
Well...
Okay, I think it should be like something that everybody has heard about, but nobody really knows who invented it. Oh my God, I've got it! Post-its! Everybody knows what Post-its are.
Yeah! They're the little yellow things with the stick-em on the back, right?
Oh. And the one of the most quotable lines from the thing is them going to a roadside cafe and ordering.
Yeah, hello. We need something to go.
Okay.
Do you have some sort of businesswoman special?
Because we're businesswomen, we're going to Tucson for business. And this brilliant waitress just looks at them and just goes, what kind of business are you girls in? And
that's a brilliant performance, isn't it?
Crumbling as they realise they have not thought about what business they're in until they decide to come up with the idea that they invented Post-its.
Which apparently was inspired by watching The Monkees.
Yeah.
Because Mike Nesmith's mum invented Tippex, and she wanted something as improbable but obviously unarguably a good business idea as inventing Tippex. I love that, because at that point in the movie, you've enjoyed them messing about and being these two friends, and you've seen
trying
them
to get their lives together. There's a brilliant bit where they say they've got 2 weeks before the reunion to get their lives together.
Okay. Well, the reunion is still like 2 weeks away, right?
Right.
And all we really need is maybe some like better jobs and boyfriends, right?
Yeah. But okay, if those things were so easy to get, wouldn't we already have them?
Well... I mean, we never really tried before. I mean, we never really had a good enough reason, like going to a reunion, to motivate us.
That's true.
But you've got a reason. But also, that's plot. They're telling you the plot.
It's brilliant. At that point, you go, well, I get where this film's going to go now. Because you go, we've had them having fun. I know who the characters are. I know in a conventional movie that isn't just character-based and isn't going to do what this film eventually does, which is just put the clocks down and freewheel down the hill.
Yeah, we will spend 20 minutes of seeing these girls try to get better jobs, try to get boyfriends.
We know what's going to happen. They're going to get caught out. What's great about this movie, especially if you're a writer, is that it goes, I don't care. Do you know what? If I didn't care, if I set up all these jeopardies and went, well, what terrible things will happen when they get found out? And it doesn't pay off on any of them. It does it all at a lovely low stakes that just allows you to enjoy the people and what they're doing.
Yes, they get caught out. they confront their bullies and they go back to into union on their own terms, and everyone thinks they're brilliant. End of film.
It is a makeover film,
yeah,
completely, yeah, on different terms.
For being themselves.
And it's, yeah, it's every bit of that is a beat that you've seen. But when you see these movies that follow those beat patterns, I remember being so angry at the movie School of Rock that I could barely speak, which is a film about rebellion that does it by following...
Is it Sarah Silverman's horrifying role as shrill girlfriend one?
No, it is just the fact that it's about rebellion and it is boilerplate Disney plotting from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Literally not a rebellious beat has got into it. It literally is. It could have been about anything. It could have been a 1970s Disney movie. It's so... The fact that it could be converted by Gillian Fellowes and Andrew Lloyd Webber tells you everything about how rebellious that film is.
It's but, a shuddering combination.
But yeah. What this
I
movie
think we should all go to the matinee after this. It's just around the corner, isn't it?
But what this movie is, it's completely on rails for hitting all the beats about you feeling for them, about unfairness, about... It hits all those children's movie beats. But delightfully, it never feels by numbers. It's always surprising.
It's so weird as well. That's what's so wonderful about it. There's so many weird lines. And I hope this is just for you, Jason, as well. That there's this bit in it where Romy's job is to get them boyfriends in time for the reunion. So she goes to a nightclub and she gets chatting to a nice guy in a nice suit. And she goes, nice suit, is that Armani? And he goes, yes. And she goes, what do you do for a living? And he says, I'm a suit salesman. And she just stares at him and just goes, I'm sorry, I have to go. I cut my foot earlier and my shoe's filling up with blood. And just walks off.
It's lovely.
We are quoting bits and giggling. Yay!
Yeah, that's it. Correct. One of the nice little paradoxes about it is that it's a very smart screenplay with lots of really dumb dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when the smart lines come out, you go, wow!
Yeah. Yeah.
The one that Janine Garofalo has towards the end, this dress exacerbates the genetic betrayal that is my legacy.
I sing along with that one.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I like you both harmonised. It was beautiful.
By the way, I'm gonna put a pin in Janine Garofalo.
Oh, yes.
Because...
Key character.
That the most I'd ever seen an actor enjoying themselves on screen was Michael Palin in the Biggest Dicker scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian. But Janine Garofalo absolutely knocks that one aside.
Oh, in which
I've
scene?
Never seen an actor, the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen an actor enjoying herself more. Yeah. She is so close to corpsing the whole fucking time.
Well, she's peak. This is peak Janine Garofalo for the 90s. She's in Mr. Show, she's in all those kind of things. She is absolutely welded in comedy history as grumpy, gothy, too much eye makeup.
When she takes her sunglasses off and she looks the same under the sunglasses, she's got so much black eye.
Like a panda. I don't know where I get my aesthetic from, but it is absolutely.
Heather Mooney from Sagebrush High in Tucson.
Yeah.
It's Romy. Romy White.
You're shitting me.
No, this is so weird. I didn't know you were living in L.A.
Well, now that you know, will we be getting together a lot?
She was a nerd at school. She's friends with Sandy Frink, who is Alan Carr. Oh, God, there's so many great things in the show, but we are going away. But her character is great because she's this grumpy woman. She was a grumpy teenager. She's now a grumpy woman who's hugely successful businesswoman who's invented this kind of quick-burning paper so that you can enjoy a cigarette.
So, God, you're driving a new Jaguar? What do you do?
Ever hear of Lady Fair cigarettes?
The ones that burn down real fast?
Twice the taste and half the time for the gal on the go. I invented the quick burning paper.
And she chain smokes the whole film. She's covered in eye makeup. She's not happy at all, despite being a millionaire.
You going to the reunion?
What reunion?
Our 10-year high school reunion in Tucson.
You're kidding me. It's been 10 years since high school? God, where have I been?
I'm stumped. Where?
Anywhere, you going?
I'd rather put this out in my ass.
And yet she's really drawn to Romy and Michelle because she hates Michelle so much because the boy she was in love with, Sandy Frink, Alan Cumming, was in love with Michelle. And again, it's this circle of thing where, you know, Michelle doesn't really know that Sandy Frink fancies her. Ginny Garofalo's character has no idea, can't tell Sandy Frink how she feels. And this reunion is all sort of, it's
going to bubble up.
It's all going to explode.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-conditioned traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
I mean, it's just because this song is, like, so great. Never mind. Unless, you know, you want to.
Yeah, I mean, sure, why not?
It's got really simple romantic lines in it that are enormously complicated once you start to untie them. You go, well, actually, in terms of playing the characters off each other, it's quite complicatedly drawn. There's a lovely... Alan Cumming said something brilliant about his part. He went, oh, I get to play the girl.
Yeah,
and the lovely thing is he gets to play the girl. He gets to play two different versions of the girl. Got an awful weird dream sequence version of the girl with Brad Pitt's jaw, which is very odd.
Do you want to talk about the massive Sandy Frink plot hole?
Are we going to do the massive Sandy Frink plot hole? We can do it, because there's a big dream sequence, 20 minutes long in the middle of it.
Yeah. Can I bring my naivete to the party here?
Hi.
I didn't realize that was a dream sequence until quite a long way into it.
You're not meant to.
It's not flagged, is it?
No.
It's wonderful. When you watch it again, like 6,000 times, you start realizing when there are so many things that tell you it's a dream sequence.
The doors open before she touches them.
There are decorations all around the reunion hall that are shaped like the fridge magnets that were stuck on Michelle's back when she had the back brace.
They're all
fruit and vegetable shaped like broccoli and banana and cherries.
But you're not meant to clock it.
You're not meant to. It just sort of goes in.
It was only the moment where the cars were in the room that I thought, what the fuck's going on? What are the cars
not when she gets
doing
hit,
in the room?
Hit by a car and rolls over it 15 times and then you think, oh, come on.
Come on.
No, that's I just thought it was fast.
I mean, it's hilarious.
I suppose the thing is that it's already heightened by the time we go to a dream sequence, so it already feels like a sort of strange dream.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful thing, because the colour palette is so over the top, and it's brilliant. I love the way that Janine Garofalo is, and her eventual beau, the cowboy, Justin Theroux, are the only people in black.
So yeah.
They're cut like holes in space out of this day glow jelly baby world. It's brilliant. They just sit there. And so everything is so heightened that when you go to the dream sequence, it feels like a very small shift. And then only when people start floating over the top of the car and things. And obviously the key line, which is, I couldn't find my top.
I'm sorry, I couldn't find my top.
Which I think is delivered about as well as any line has ever been delivered.
Yeah, so the whole thing is Michelle's dream, which you sort of... you're completely right. You're not meant to sort of realise it's a... weird beat for a film to have a massive dream.
Also,
before you get to the reunion, you see a fake version of the reunion.
And also, her dream features Romy and has things that Romy's doing in it that she couldn't possibly see.
We cut away from her to her conversations that she's having at the reunion.
They're so close, they are in each other's dreams.
Yes, and that absolutely... The thing is, you can justify most weird plot things in it by that's the character. The only thing that doesn't make any sense at all is Sandy Frink. In the real world of the thing, we know that Sandy Frink is also a millionaire because he's also an inventor, because he invented a certain kind of rubber that's used in every kind of trainer in North America, sneaker in North America. And Romy and Michelle do not have this information to hand at all. And yet Michelle, for 20 minutes of her dream sequence, dreams that he's so rich he can buy himself a new face. and he's got this beautiful like prosthetic plastic surgery.
It's really good, the prosthesis.
It's good, isn't it? Apparently
good.
He like picked out like body parts, like Brad Pitt's chin and stuff like that.
Alec Baldwin's lips.
Yes.
Oh, really?
It's a wonderful one where Alan Cumming is believable as a heterosexual man. That's how camp this film is.
Michelle, after all these years, you still take my breath away.
Thanks.
And also, it's got this odd aesthetic that's almost the fetishization of clothes isn't even female. It's almost like drag. And there was a thing that Mira Sorvino said that her body language, she wanted to be, especially in the dance routines, like a linebacker in drag.
Yeah.
But there's a sort of fetishization of clothes and the identity through clothes that almost feels not even what two girls would be like. It's heightened beyond that.
Drag queens love Romeo and Michelle for lots of reasons, but because it's a brilliant film, but also because it's about two women who can't afford, like, they're clearly poor. It's not Clueless where everyone's rich. These are two women who we never hear about their parents, we never hear about their background, but clearly they have no money when they're at high school and they make all their own clothes. And in adult life, that turns out to be a very important plot point in the thing, that making their own clothes is how they express themselves. It's really important to the drag community because it's about like expressing yourself through your clothes and making your own outfits.
Yeah,
you can't just buy things off the peg. You've got to make stuff for your body. And that's why they look amazing throughout the whole film, because they've made a virtue out of, hang on, what's the way around? Necessity out of virtue? What's the...
There's lovely bits. Their characters do come to it. It's really, really weird when they wear their business suits. And even though they look great in those business suits, well, that's not quite them. And at the end of it, there's a lovely detail that Mira Sorvino asked for Star Trek detailing in her final prom dress, because she's a big Star Trek nerd. Every bit of it is about them expressing themselves.
Well, when we see the first prom, when they're 18 and they are graduating from high school, and everyone else, as Michelle puts it so beautifully, all the other girls are dressed like they're going to a hoedown.
Yeah.
They're all wearing flouncy, boring bridesmaids dress kind of prom gowns, and Romeo and Michelle are dressed like 1989 Madonna. You look so good with blonde hair and black roots, it's not even funny. Again, don't know where I get my aesthetic from, but
what's lovely about it, and it's building towards the fight, when you're thinking, how would you plot a film like this that is deliberately light on plot and light on, obviously you want all those brilliant denouements and payoffs and punishments, things all pay off beautifully. It's really cleverly done.
Yeah, the bullies, we haven't really talked about the bullies.
Yes.
They are horrible. They put fridge magnets on their back, they steal their food,
they're very
torture
heathers.
Them. They play horrible pranks on them. They're really horrible women.
They really are, aren't they?
Do you want to know a lovely fact about the bullies? This is my favourite trivia fact. I found this out today.
Okay.
You might know this. Julia Campbell, who plays Christy Masters, the head bully.
Yeah.
When she was 11, she was a ballerina, and she was retired from ballerina because she had scoliosis and had to wear a metal back brace at school.
Ooh.
So she is the one who bullies Michelle for having a back brace, and she went through that at school. And I think that's a lovely detail.
That is.
The thing with every time she turns her head, it squeaks. What a beautiful touch that is.
Yeah. Hi, Michelle. Gee, Michelle, you're looking really lovely today.
Okay, see you in biology.
Oh, it's just, I just, that suddenly gave it a depth, and you went, oh, even the actors and things are probably channeling. Everyone felt like this at school. It's incredibly empathetic about what it feels like to be excluded. That lovely thing where they're describing who is the A group, who is the B group, were we the C group? We weren't even the C group.
Yeah, there was the drama group, there was this group.
They just end up being in the background of the high school photos, don't they?
Yeah, all the time.
Lovely line, do you remember the fuss we had about getting our high school photograph taken together in the yearbook? They're the only people who've got a photo with both of them in. Because they are in that lovely situation, which you do in a, especially in American high school, where it's all very hierarchical, where if you've only got one friend, then that will be inseparable because that's your gang.
That's your group, yeah. And to go back to the bullies as well, at the end, when they are even more horrible women at the end, when they are, and they're all pregnant. And
It sort of confers them some virtue, doesn't it? Which they... They're absolutely confound by being fucking awful.
Yeah, they're horrible women. But then you actually sort of start thinking about if you're 28 and you've had three kids and you've clearly not left the town where this high school is and you've married your high school sweetheart, they're riddled with insecurities about these two women coming in from LA in their business suits and all that kind of stuff. And so you get why they start undermining them and chipping away at them immediately.
God, you're so weird.
Why don't you just leave her alone?
Michelle.
Oh, it's the back brace girl.
Hi, back brace girl.
It reminded me a little bit of This Is Spinal Tap.
Yes.
Because in This Is Spinal Tap, when we recorded an episode about that with Sue Perkins, we were talking about these two little boys and their friendship, because that's what they are. And I thought in this one, these are two little girls trying to be grown-ups, even when they're not trying to dress up to do, you know, we're successful LA post-it millionaires. Even when they're just being themselves, they're still two little girls trying to be grown-ups, aren't they? They're trying to work out adulthood.
Absolutely. And I think the language that Robin Schiff uses in the dialogue is really, it's so beautifully chosen because it's so simple. It's not baroque and it's not with Nailey. Actually,
they've got their own way of talking that you can copy.
Absolutely.
Like Bill and Ted or Wayne's World, but it's not complicated.
But the big speech that they do at the end, which makes everyone cry, when they confront the bullies, and I would like the quiet one, Jason Hatley, to do a dramatic reading of the last speech.
Readers with me.
It's such a beautiful speech, and the language of it is so simple. It is the language of a child, and it absolutely is. It's so moving.
What the hell is your problem, Christy? Why the hell are you always such a nasty bitch? I mean, okay, so Michelle and I did make up some stupid lie. We only did it because we wanted you to treat us like human beings. But you know what I realised? I don't care if you like us, because we don't like you. You're a bad person with an ugly heart, and we don't give a flying fuck what you think. A bad person with an ugly heart. I mean, and most of it is one syllable, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's lovely.
I am crying.
Are you? My God.
It's so moving.
There's that dynamic about saying everyone has it within them to be mean. Mm. And when Janine Garofalo finds out that she hurt Toby's feelings, she's delighted because they go, oh, I was always a victim, but to find out you really upset me. Oh, good, did
yeah,
I?
There's
you feel
one, yeah,
that
there's
power.
Only one character in it who you could say probably didn't ever bully anyone, and that's Toby, who's a very extraordinarily upbeat character throughout the whole film.
Great performance. She's just there to be told to fuck off.
Fuck off, Toby.
But at the end, she ends up triumphant. She ends up, there's enormous empathy for her and things. Yeah, she doesn't get to bully anybody, but you wonder whether there's someone offstage.
Well, there probably
is. There's a cycle of people who are bullied. Your thing about them being little girls, and I was trying to work out why this film is magical and unique, and I think it is. There are endless films like Spinal Tap in which men are allowed and excused behaving like their 9-year-old selves.
They've
usually got the girlfriends on the poster with their arms crossed, rolling their eyes. The standard thing where a Zach Galifianakis or a Seth Rogen movie in which the guy takes no responsibility and a woman goes, when are you going to grow up? There are, I think, I'm trying to count them now, one film where two 9-year-old girls are allowed to still be 9-year-old girls, and it's all in that dance routine at the end where they dance like 9-year-old girls.
I'm so glad you loved it, Jason. Worth every penny of the $250,000 that Time After Time cost. It's beautiful.
It is so preposterous and gorgeous.
Yeah, it makes you feel everything at the same time when you watch that dance.
We
can't do it. Watch it. Watch the film. It's wonderful. It's about the two friends. It's Alan Cumming somehow magically. It's not the dream sequence. It's actually meant to be real. If he actually knows all the moves that they're doing.
But they're together, but apart. Yeah. There's a brilliant thing where Lisa Kudrow is just, it takes a while to notice, he's just posing because he's not an natural dancer, so she just poses and is like a model. And Mira Sorvino did ballet class as a kid, so she's jumping around in her bare feet, doing pirouettes. Like, it happens at Christmas where you get kids around and they say, I'm going to do a show for
you. Exactly like children dancing at a wedding. Yeah. In fact, if I am ever at a wedding and Time After Time comes on, find me.
We will do
it. I know every move.
What David Merkin did was originally the dance routine at the first prom was just going to be Staying Alive, like a comedy dance routine. They would do a bit of something Napoleon Dynamite, it's like naff 80s dancing.
Which they do in the club, and it's very funny. They clearly spend a lot of time practicing dance routines, which is again what girls do.
It's a good setup, dancing in front of the mirror kind of thing. Yeah. So they do that. And the important thing is that the first prom, they couldn't find partners to dance with. They got stood up, and so they danced together. And in the final dance, where finally Sandy Frink asks Michelle to dance, and she goes, only if Romy can dance too. I didn't want her to see her dance with the boy. I wanted to see her dance with her friend. And it's like Wannabe by the Spice Girls. It's the same message. You've got to get with... It's that thing. It's a very similar era, saying there's no point looking for romance as the answer if you're going to lose your friends. If you fall, I will catch you.
The fact that you could never in a million years describe this as a rom-com, a heterosexual rom-com. It's a story about the romance between two women, platonic, non-lesbian, they say, made that very clear at the beginning of the film.
only if we're still single at 30.
Yeah, exactly.
Ask me again.
When I was like, and it's so thrown away, that line. There's no like, ugh in it. It's just like, oh, the idea of sleeping with a woman skews me out. But ask me again when I'm 30. Sure, okay. and then it's never touched on again. They're just in love with each other. They're just a loving couple, heterosexual life partners. But it's not a rom-com between, even though Michelle gets together with Sandy Frink, spoiler alert, from the beginning of the film, it is very obvious that these two women don't care about anything except each other, probably coming from broke backgrounds. They want to have money and security. And again, the second she finds out that Sandy Frink has some money, it's like, well, I'm going to get together with Sandy Frink then. And that's venal. It's just like a given.
It's only an answer to get her the money so she can stay with Romy.
Yeah, so they open a shop selling things and let's fold scarves.
Let's fold scarves.
Final line. That's as good as Nobody's Perfect as a final line.
Let's fold scarves.
Okay.
There's a brilliant line in one of the dream sequences where it suddenly cuts to 70 years later and they're old.
Yeah.
And she's with Sandy Frink and they're both old and aging makeup. And he goes, were you terribly unhappy? No, just lonely with no one to talk to. And so you're told that 25 minutes before the end that even if she gets together with the man of her dreams, it won't be enough.
No, because they've had a big fight and they're not talking to each other and they don't talk to each other for 70 years.
The source of the row, I mean, it's a French and Saunders sketch, the source of the row. Mm. The source of the row is the perfect low-stakes 9-year-old's row.
Yeah.
They fall out with almost no reason while driving, dressed as businesswoman, over which one's the Mary and which one's the Rhoda from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
And which one of them was more likely to have invented Post-its and which one would have just have said, let's make them yellow.
And obviously, the only thing about that is, watching it, you go, but that's your characters. One of you is the ideas person and one of you is the fashion person.
Yeah, which comes together beautifully at the end when they talk about their lovely dresses that they made and bring out the car, their beautiful Star Trek dresses, where it's just like, well, I designed them, we both made them. And it's just, oh...
It's great because the jeopardy is that they've fallen out. No one has made them fall out. There's no person to destroy it. Even the bullies haven't made them fall out. They've fallen out on their own terms. So they can come together on their own terms. It's brilliant. The threat to the beautiful friendship you're watching is really small. So you're kind of all the way through going, I know they're not really going to not be friends. So it makes it even more... There's not a moment where you've not got constant joy watching this because you know they're not really in danger.
Mm.
Though it is horrible to watch them not be friends. You could feel it.
Oh, absolutely. It's really uncomfortable, that bit. But the nice... It was a strange ending, I thought, because it's sort of... It's almost convincing. You go... Michelle has got her man. Romy is along for the ride.
Yeah,
and they basically they float into the sky in a helicopter.
They go off an helicopter,
which is lovely,
leaving behind Ramon's car that they've borrowed at the beginning of the film, abandoning it forever.
His Jaguar.
That's a plot hole, but I don't care.
I love how the Americans say Jaguar.
Jaguar garage.
She works in a Jaguar garage.
Jaguar garage. But they borrow the Porsche Jaguar off Ramon, and then they
Ramon,
and then they. completely abandon it, and I don't care, because that's exactly the kind of thing they do. They just do it. They don't care.
But the lovely thing is that it, even though you're going, well, hang on, there's a spare part in this helicopter, isn't there? You know, in the form of Romy.
But
you go,
Sandy Frink. Sandy Frink is the first.
Because they are, and then I went, oh, that's why she was wearing a Three of Hearts t-shirt in that earlier scene, isn't it? Because it's three hearts.
Oh,
that's what it is, isn't it?
I never noticed that.
I never spotted that. Oh, you think they were a throuple?
I don't think they were a problem.
That's a hell of a reading.
No, I just thought that they all love each other for different reasons.
Yeah.
Instead,
yes.
These are the three of hearts rising into the sky. There you go.
That's beautiful.
And the ending, the tacked-on ending, which isn't tacked-on, it's the proper ending, was added by David Merkin, because originally I think it ended with them going to the sky and the end of a high school reunion movie, the makeover. They come in, they bin themselves, and therefore they're rewarded with Millionaire's Helicopter. That lovely line, wouldn't it, the only thing that would make this better is if everyone came out to watch us take off, which they immediately
they do.
Yeah. So you take off, and it's basically the end of Grease. They go up into the sky, and then it cuts to the two of them together without Sandy Frink.
Yeah.
And David Merkin
in
is bang on.
In a shop on Rodeo Drive.
You don't care about the romance. You want to see the two of them together.
No,
and
no,
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And they get to give Heather the gift of clothes.
She's been given the gift of fashion. I love it. She plucks out her eyebrow hair and she freaks out and she goes, don't come near my bikini line. And Michelle has no idea what she's talking about and just goes, okay, I won't.
can we just do, they are brilliant. The two of them. I really, really love Lisa Kudrow. I think she's absolutely brilliant. Amira Savino, I thought, was fantastic. So I loved her in things. She'd won an Oscar by the time.
Yep.
This is her Oscar follow-up film for Mighty Aphrodite. And again, fuck the Oscars. I've never watched Mighty Aphrodite more than once. I have watched this thousands of times.
Mighty Aphrodite was, she just won the Oscar. It was a prestigious role, her big, Woody Allen film. And regardless, nothing at all to do with Woody Allen and what people say about it and all that kind of stuff. Literally, it's a horrible, weird performance that she sort of made this choice with this funny voice, and it's so soulless. Like, she's brilliant. She's a brilliant actress. But it's a horrible, mean joke, the plot of Mighty Aphrodite is that Woody Allen, who is Woody Allen, has this lovely adopted son, and he decides he's going to meet the mother of the who gave up the child, and she turns out to be a sex worker. And not only is that, but she also has a funny voice, and she's quite bad taste in things, and is quite working class. And
that's the joke.
She's a vulgar person who collects things like pottery penises and stuff like that. And it's like, that's the joke.
It's a snob comedy. It's horrible.
And he sort of does this Pygmalion thing, trying to make her over so that when the son seeks out the mother. And it's such a horrible, mean-spirited role. She's brilliant. But then I love that her next role was this. And she must have had to wrestle with, am I going to do another idiot character? She was going out of Quentin Tarantino when they made this film. There's a red apple cigarette sign in the background, which means that it's part of the Tarantino
universe. It's happening in the background of Pulp Fiction. Yes. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
But they are
this thing's got tentacles, isn't it?
Right?
But they are so good
together. Layers.
They are so good together. It's such a beautiful piece of casting. And it's a buddy movie. And again, there aren't many female buddy movies. I was listing the ones that people that are widely available and you can watch again and again. It's Thelma and Louise and this and you start.
And then have to die at the end.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. It celebrates it. And it's what feels odd about this is it is unique. And you think this works? I could watch dozens of these. I've certainly watched dozens of the boys' version of this.
Yeah, there's lots of films about female friendship and how important they are. And Ghost World came out around the same time.
That's the other thing it reminded me of. The hate watching at the beginning is very, very, very Ghost World.
We do, that's such a beautiful subversion of that. So where they're hate fucking Pretty Woman and going like, oh, like all those women who work in Rodeo Drive stores aren't massive prostitutes themselves. And they watch the scene where Julia Roberts is not allowed to shop, and Michelle just lets out this sob and just goes, I'm just so happy when they finally let her shop. And it's true.
But it's also the beginning of that movie. What it says is, this is the tone of this movie, this is who it's for. You can see yourself reflected. If you hate watch Pretty Woman, this is for you. You're in it. You don't have to be an airhead. You don't have to be it's got the same accessibility of saying, if you like these guys and they're very likeable, the first thing they seem to do is something you do at home. This understands that once you've got the carriage moving with those two characters in, you can just leave it. You don't need complicated plot or anything, you just want to watch them. I love its confidence in saying that those two characters, those two actors, are enough.
Yeah.
Butch and Sundance style, for me to just watch them do stuff.
And it's such a simple message, which is, friendship's important, which is, always a message worth saying, but also that everyone is an underdog.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks they are an underdog, and everyone has the capability of hurting someone and healing someone.
Have you been to a school reunion?
No.
Have you not?
God, no.
I went to one a few years ago.
I've literally burnt all my bridges on that front. I waved goodbye to Bristol, set fire to the Severn Bridge, and I've never been back.
Don't you want to go back and find out who you bullied? Or do you know?
Oh, God.
Was it Banksy?
Why do you think he does all those really sad pictures there? That was me.
I went to one a few years ago, and it was actually a primary school reunion, right?
What?
Now, a lot of the people there...
Remember when we ate paint together?
Yeah. A lot of the people there had been at secondary school together. I hadn't. I went to a different secondary school to most of them. So I hadn't seen some of those people there for 30 years, right? And... So obviously you can't say, so what have you been up to? Because that's way too much time to cover in a conversation. Mm. So we just go to, what did you do today? You know, how are you getting on? Had a few drinks. And by the end of the evening, we all absolutely loved each other. Oh. We were all so pleased to see each other again.
Oh.
It's a great thing. It's like that's, you know, that it has that kind of, that core of friendship thing. It goes, it's never gone away. Last time I saw you, you were 11 and now you're however old you are now and you're lovely.
But that must be like a chemical memory, like something primal. Because you're not going to go like, oh, remember when we built that Robin Hood forest together? No, like you just weren't...
There was someone there who said, don't you remember that we once went into, there was a large concrete pipe down where some building was being done, down by the river, and we went in there. We must have been about 8, and we kissed, and then I ran away.
And that said, was no, the film
I've got,
It.
I've got no recollection of this whatsoever, no, nothing. But it was just lovely to see everybody again.
And you off with them in a concrete tunnel.
Yeah.
Did you lose weight? Actually, I have been trying this new fat-free diet I invented. All I've had to eat for the past 6 days are gummy bears, jelly beans, and candy corns. God, I wish I had your discipline.
Should we have some American sweets?
Yeah, I bought some of Romy and Michelle's favourite food.
Can I do the diet thing?
That bit where they give up dieting, and then there's that shot where the camera just crawls across the biggest mountain of candy you've ever seen, and they're both sitting there stuffing themselves with I don't know what it is, and in the background there's a cat eating a cake.
Yeah, the cat never gets mentioned again.
They abandoned the cat.
But yes, anyway, I bought red rope Twizzlers and candy corns.
I've never had candy corns. Isn't the rule with American sweets is if you didn't grow up with them, they're not nice. They're horrible because it's all about nostalgia.
I gave some Americans some shrimp once, foam shrimp. They were very unhappy.
This is horrible. This is all nostalgia and nothing else, but candy corns, quite nice. Ooh.
It is. I mean, those shrimps are an acquired taste, aren't they?
Just an odd thing to explain to someone. I know they're sweets, but... in the shape of shrimp.
I wonder if you haven't had them before you're an adult, whether you look at them and your brain is going, but shrimp? I'm expecting seafood, and all I'm getting is a kind of weird, sugary, foamy thing.
Oh, God, I'm getting an American sugar rush now. That didn't take long. Whoa.
Nice.
Normally, you have to choose one or the other. Yeah. You can either watch a harrowing film about teenage bullying, or you can watch Ferris Bueller. And Romy Michelle's is kind of magically
Romy Michelle, apart from the odd F word, is literally a children's film. Mm. It's not even sexy, even though they're talking about romance and there's a couple of sort of vague references. It's sort of sexless. It's a sexless friendship film.
It's that weird thing when they're doing, even the costume design, when they're doing the gym stuff and they're wearing literally the sluttiest outfits you could wear to go to the gym.
But then
it's not sexy.
No, they're Barbie dolls. They're wearing Barbie costumes. They're wearing what you'd put Barbie in if she was going to the gym. Like a little strappy top with anchors on.
And Barbie.
Yeah.
It's really odd because it manages.
They are Business Barbie. Oh my God. She looks so much like Business Barbie, Lisa Kudrow in that bit. Yeah.
Oh, all it is this is just made of heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's why I love it. That's why I wanted to do this for this and not, you know, some big complicated comedy thing where we were going to have to hold it in our hands very fragile and look at every facet.
Because it's just made of heart and it's made of love and it has no purpose apart from to delight you. The number of times I've read reviews of this, it gets 62% on Rotten Tomatoes.
2 stars on Empire, I read the review the other day. Yeah.
And it's a film that people go...
Some bloke just going, I don't really like it, it's about some airheads, and I didn't really understand it. It's like, it's not for you.
It is totally dismissible, but that's incredibly brave. Because what you'd normally do is halfway through the process, you'd go, we better put some meat in this. And they go, no, it's completely purged of anything apart from delight and air. And the idea that...
It is the sweets. It's a pile of sweets, yeah. This film, isn't it? Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, even the colour palette does that on screen. It looks like a load of sweets.
But it's a bit like saying that a Black Forest Gâteau is worthless because it doesn't have sausages in it. Yeah. This knows what it is. And the thing about it is that those films are rare, that are complete successes on the terms of being fluffy, enjoyable, escapism. It's like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. It's like, it's one of those movies you can watch that will lift your mood, like Singing in the Rain.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
And I think there are enough movies that are also formally brilliant and have depth and drama. Mm-hmm. But this has got, I mean, the idea that it's easy to make one of these, there would be more of them.
I would defy anyone to watch the Time After Time dance sequence and not feel happier afterwards. Not just feel a kind of a weird, giddy joy, in the same way that watching Singing in the Rain would make you feel like that. If you can watch those three tit about like kids at a disco.
Yeah. And I think I think that when we talk about...
When he rolls on the floor. I know. I'm sorry, I'm quoting bits now. I'm giggling.
Quoting dance moves.
I'm quoting a dance move.
It's like, I'm going to put a clip in of that dance move and all you're going to hear is like 8 notes. It's fine. We're talking about this, and we're giddy, we're delightful, we're delighting, and we're happy, and the real thing is, you go, this is a comedy discussion podcast. You go, we can't really talk about Romy Michelle's. It's just really funny and lovely. You go, that's all it has
also,
to be.
If you've ever been in the pub with the three of us, we can go deep dive on like Jam or something like that. We'll spend hours. Oh, did you do the props master? And this is way more fun to eat sweets with my friends and talk about a film that delights us. More fun.
And that, with a mouthful of candy, is the perfect place to bring it to a close.
I'll prep my chopper.
Do you have a final Jason. Thought on this about whether it's funny or not?
long silence. I haven't said anything for a while. I mean, it is fucking funny.
Sarah, thank you for bringing Romy and Michelle.
Thanks, Morgs.
Hey.